Counsel for the next case, you can come up to counsel table. Good morning.
Good morning.
The next case on our calendar today is A24-1381, James David Colburn versus Wenjin Ginny Colburn. And please correct my pronunciation of appellant's name if I mispronounced it. I'll give you a minute to get settled. Counsel will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll ask that you please introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument and the client you represent for purposes of the recording. The recording will be available on our website within approximately 24 hours. So, counsel, for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Deborah Gallenberg, and I represent Wenjin Ginny Colburn in this matter, and she's the appellant, and we are here to appeal several provisions of the findings of fact and order for judgment entered July 11th of 2024. For ease, I'll just refer to it as the July 12th, 2024 judgment. There's two primary issues with the judgment that I wanted to discuss with the court today. The first one is the court's order in paragraph 5 of the order requiring the parties to split the children's extracurricular activities according to their percentage of income shares for child support. I'm asking that the court vacate that portion of the order. The second is with respect to the district court's orders regarding the tax credits or the dependency exemptions, as they've been referred to in the statute, for the minor children. I'm asking that the court remand its order in paragraph 7 of the order denying Ms. Colburn's request for compensation of $2,500, which was the value of the 2023 tax credits for her for the minor children, which she was awarded in the prior judgment from the Wisconsin court. And I'm asking that the court vacate the district court's order allocating the tax credits or dependency exemptions between the parties moving forward. There's also a third issue that we've briefed regarding the correction of a clerical error. It's kind of a minor issue where in finding of fact 17 of the order, the court said it was in one place not adopting the recommendations of the guardian ad litem. In another spot, it said it was. It's pretty clear that it was. Whether the Court of Appeals corrects that today or remands it to the district court.
Ms. Gallenberg, can I ask you, going back to the tax dependency, I perhaps missed this in your arguments, but it just struck me that I thought you were primarily focusing on an error being the retroactivity. In other words, it was undisputed that your client had the tax credit in 2023 of the children, and he used it nevertheless, and that's where the source of the $2,500. But you're also arguing there's error in alternating thereafter. And on that issue, the statute is pretty clear in the case law. There's quite a wide deference before we would find an abuse of discretion, and alternating seems almost inherently the most equal way to go. So what basis is there an abuse of discretion in alternating the dependency credit?
So under Minnesota Statute 518A.38, the court is required to make express findings where there's not an agreement to alternate, or there's not an agreement regarding the income tax dependency exemptions. The provisions that the court is required to analyze are under subdivision B. The court is required, so if the parties disagree on who gets the tax credits, or as they're referred to in the statute, the dependency exemptions, the court is required to make express findings on the financial resources of each party, if awarding the dependency exemptions negatively would impact a parent's ability to provide for the children, or if not awarding the tax credits would. If only one party or both parties would receive a financial benefit from the dependency exemptions when they're claimed on their tax returns. And then there's a subdivision about the Affordable Care Act, which is not applicable in this matter. And the statute specifically states that if there is no agreement, the court has to make findings on those. In this case, there was no agreement, but there was no motion pending by either party to modify the allocation of those. And in order to modify the allocation of those, there has to be a substantial change to the factors under subdivision 7.
So it doesn't appear the court made the necessary findings. Would you agree with that in the
Correct,
order?
Your Honor.
So would it be more appropriate for us to remand back to the district court to consider the factors rather than simply vacating the allocation?
Well, in this instance, because there was no motion pending under the Minnesota Rule of General Practice 303, I don't know that the evidence is necessarily in the record to make those findings. I mean, the court certainly has discretion to remand the issue back to the district court, but there was never any motion filed by either party to modify them. The motion that was filed was by Ms. Colburn, and in that motion, she asked for the compensation of $2,500 based on a calculation we did that was the value of the benefit that she lost as a result of Mr. Colburn having claimed those credits in 2023.
So is there any case law that you can cite us to that suggests it's an abuse of discretion for the district court to sua sponte, make such allocations on a going forward basis, assuming it had considered the factors?
Your Honor, there's not a lot of case law on either of the issues I'm talking about before the court today. I'm assuming that people consider the financial benefit, which is always a consideration in appealing. But I mean, I think the statute itself is clear on its face about what the criteria is and the fact that the court would have to find a substantial change in order to modify them.
Thank you.
The other kind of interesting issue that I've thought about as I've been preparing for oral argument is that the value of Ms. Colburn's lost benefit for the 2023 tax returns and her loss of the tax benefits for the children was $2,500. Under subdivision G of the statute, there is a provision that says when a party has claimed the income tax dependency exemption in violation of the court order, then the court's recourse is to basically provide the other party or award the party the value of that lost credit and the value of the attorney fees. It is discretionary and it says may. And I did some research on that and there's not any cases that I could find as to how the court exercised that discretion. How does the court decide? Does the other party get the value of that lost tax credit? But it certainly would seem, because by the statute, that if the court is denying that request for compensation, it's essentially retroactively modifying the allocation of the tax credit, because Ms. Colburn had been awarded that tax credit. Mr. Colburn took it. So it would seem that the court would analyze the factors under subdivision 7 in considering that. The other provision and kind of thought that's in play with respect to the tax credits is there were a number of other financial motions pending before the court at the time. Ms. Colburn had also asked for an increase in spousal maintenance. There's information in the record on the party's incomes. And I think that there's no consideration in the order from the court as to kind of how Ms. Colburn would cope with the adjustments to the tax credits going forward. and whether the spousal maintenance then should change as a result, because all of the orders are kind of linked together, usually in a divorce case where you have spousal maintenance, child support, the tax credits. I just wanted to move on.
Before you do, and this is kind of a broad question, perhaps on both issues, you're about to go to the other issue, I assume. The counsel for respondent makes the point that the district court did have a plethora of financial information with regard to the issues, even if some of these weren't directly four square in front of the judge, like the one we were just talking about, and even to a great extent, look at the extracurricular activity. I didn't see that there was any direct motion and much discussion about that. But would it be fair to say, though, that both are related to financial information, income of the parties, the debts, their expenses? The judge had all of that in front of her, such that would it be reasonable for us to imply the findings necessary, that which I think is kind of what the respondent's asking us to do, in the absence of explicit findings?
I think that had the findings been made in the order, that could be a solution. But with respect to the party's motions to modify spousal maintenance, for example, the court explicitly found that the party's financial circumstances had not substantially changed under its analysis regarding spousal maintenance. And in order to modify the income tax allocation, the court needs to find a substantial change in the circumstances of the parties under subdivision 7. And the first kind of prong is the financial resources of each party. Since the court had made findings that those haven't changed or hadn't changed to warrant a modification of spousal maintenance, it wouldn't follow that you can imply for the purposes of the tax credits that there had been that substantial change.
Because it's the contrary. It's an explicit finding.
That there had not been any change.
I see.
And would there be any indication in the case law that those findings would be different? I guess, right, because you're also asking us to sort of infer for the purpose of the other question, right? And I think that your argument is it's the same factors, it's the same facts. And so if circumstances haven't changed in one area, then that would indicate that those same findings would go to other aspects of the court's decision. And I'm just asking if there's any case law that would indicate something different needs to be found.
There's very limited case law I found on both of the issues, both of the extracurricular issue and then the tax issue. And I mean, quite frankly, there's not a lot of case. I mean, there's not any case that I could find where the Court of Appeals actually went through the individual factors. But I think just based upon the record before the district court, based on their findings on the spousal maintenance issue, I don't know how you could get there that the resources of the parties had not changed and then modify the tax credits. I mean, the court also found that Mr. Colburn's income had increased, that he had the ability to pay the cost of living adjustment for spousal maintenance. I mean, the court found that his income was a couple times in terms of the PICs. It's 79%, 21%. So it's much greater than Ms. Colburn's income. And so one of the factors the court needs to look at, and there were tax returns in the record, is whether given Mr. Colburn's higher income, he would even realize the same financial benefit that a lower income person like Ms. Colburn would receive.
It's true, though, counsel, the judge at least did, in I think it's finding 23 under tax credits, made reference, didn't go, as you point out, through all the factors in the statute, but did both recognize that it was to be your clients, but then it was appropriate given the living situation of the children. So that would at least indicate, now I assume you would agree would be a reasonable finding given the need for the expense of the deduction, correct?
Yeah, and I don't know exactly. I did note that was the only finding the court made was the living situation of the children. I don't know if that would apply to like the financial circumstances of the parties or how that would apply to the analysis under 518A.38 subdivision 7. Just wanted to touch briefly on the issue of the extracurricular activities. there's no legal basis under 518A24 subdivision 4, which pertains to basic child support, for the court to order parties to split extracurricular activities under a statute unless, one, they agree and they've contracted to the expenses. And there's many Court of Appeals unpublished and published opinions on that, where parties agree to split extracurricular activities. They're part of the order, they're part of the contract, and the parties agree. Here, that's not the case. There was not any agreement. There's no court order in place requiring the parties to split extracurricular activities. The other basis is under the McNulty case of 1993, which is a case that's, I was doing the math, and it's over 30 years old. That's kind of the case that's cited for this proposition that the court could order an upward deviation for ordering parties to share extracurricular activities. Otherwise, they're included.
It'd be true that McNulty, however, did not rule as a matter of law that extracurricular activities are a part of basic child support. It just happened to be that that was the basis for the deviation in the district court. That's the way the district court analyzed it, and that's how the parties argued it before our court. But that was the question here is a little bit different, because you're citing that case for the proposition that extracurricular activities is part of basic support, and yet that phrase is not used in the statute, and no case has actually said that it is. Would that be an accurate summary of the law?
Yes. So in addition to agreeing to share extracurricular activities, the court could order that if it were to find an upward deviation. And in this case, the court did not find.
What I'm getting at is, why would it have to be a deviation of all if it's not a part of basic support? I mean, it might be amount of establishing support or a modification of support. But my point being is that if it has not been determined as a matter of law that extracurricular is part of basic support, that means it hasn't yet been calculated. It hasn't been considered.
So I think, I mean, under the statute, I've routinely seen the citation that the basic support is to support things like the educational needs, other expenses, clothing, basically everything that's listed in subdivision 4, except basic support doesn't cover childcare expenses or medical expenses.
But it doesn't say extracurricular. I understand your point. It's a reasonable argument, and perhaps, in fact, your clients might disagree as to whether extracurricular is equal to educational needs. My point being is, it just seems like an unsettled issue as to whether, in fact, extracurricular is included in the basic support. We know what's excluded, and we have some definitions. You just read them, what's included. Does that necessarily mean extracurricular is my question?
Well, and I think that's a great question, because extracurricular is not defined in the order. So part of the issue is under this court's order of July 11th, 2024, is an extracurricular activity something different from an educational expense under the statute? But I would agree that the words extracurricular is not in the statute.
And this is another one of those issues that was not specifically part of a motion, if I understand correctly. It was just tucked into the order. Is that fair to say? In other words, it didn't appear to me from the record that the parties were heavily litigating, if at all,
no,
the issue of extracurricular
kind of,
and how to divide that.
It just kind of got put in the order. Yeah, and there's no indication in the record what this child's activity costs are. There's some indication in the monthly expenses that Mr. Colburn was paying the kids extracurricular activities, as Ms. Colburn didn't have any in her budget for spousal maintenance. But the court didn't have, it wasn't like the McNulty case where there was, you know, $1,800 of expenses for the child each month that Mr. Colburn came in saying, I need an upward deviation of child support. And there's no limit on what this could look like under the order either. So
thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Counsel, my name is Katie Lammers, and I represent the respondent, James Colburn, in this matter. The parties in this matter were participants in some extensive litigation, both in Wood County, Wisconsin, where there were multiple orders called addendums and amendments to addendums that were issued before the case got transferred over to Carver County. The issues before the court here today have to do with some of the rulings that were made in Wisconsin and how they are now reflected in the Carver County orders. As indicated, we're talking about the July 11th, 2024 order. There are multiple motions before the court that the court addressed, as we've talked about, cross motions to modify maintenance, motions regarding child support. The record was extensive as it related to the amount of financial information that was provided to the district court. There was also a vocational assessment performed on Ms. Colburn that was provided to the district court. And after reviewing all of that information, the court did make some determinations, and obviously at issue here today are the matters of the tax dependency exemption and the extracurricular activities, both of which were actually dealt with in Wisconsin orders and then modified in Minnesota orders. The Wisconsin orders talked about, we know the case is going to Minnesota, so we may be looking at modifications under Minnesota law. The revised addendum from Wood County references this concept of variable expenses. And when you look at that addendum, there's a definition in there of what variable expenses are. And those include extracurricular expenses. So I'm going to start with the extracurricular expense issue first. Originally in Wisconsin, the parties had joint custody of the kids, and in Wisconsin, that's how the variable expenses are allocated. So if you each have essentially 50% parenting time, you share your variable expenses 50-50. One of the last orders, right before coming to Minnesota, awarded Mr. Colburn primary residence and custody of the children. At that point, Wood County said, well, because of this now, and there were some undated requests for variable expense contributions, so it couldn't really tell when the dates of the contributions being requested were. They said, okay, now because you have sole custody, we're going to put a pause on the variable expenses, and then the case goes to Minnesota. But notably, Your Honors, there was no, like, termination of that provision. There was no sunset on that concept, generally speaking. The Carver County Court had heard multiple motions. The parties agreed to appoint a private guardian ad litem to look out for the best interests of the children. So here, what the court did is it said, okay, we've got cross motions for support. One of the kids emancipated. One of the children is now seeing mom. So it's essentially time to deal with extracurricular activities, which are always dealt with outside the notion of basic support. I don't think I've ever heard an argument that they were part of educational expenses under the definition of the statute.
Why wouldn't they fall under the language of subdivision for the definition of basic support, which includes other expenses related to the child's care?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think extracurriculars are necessarily related to the child's care. Basic support is designed to be for essentially room and board and housing and things of that nature. And because extracurricular expenses are so significant, they're not educational expenses. So I think there's a lot in what's not in that wording as opposed to what it is. I don't see, and whenever I look at cases, extracurricular activities applying to their care, it's more of an enhancement, I think, of their life and probably something that's, certainly beneficial to their growth and development, but not directly related to care. And I would go so far to say that if the legislature intended that, they would have expressly put that word in the definition.
Ms. Lammers, how much of the explanation you provided in terms of the history in Wisconsin, the variable expenses, how it had been and when it changed, was actually presented at this motion hearing to the district court, such that, because I understand you, part of your point being is that in the end, this would not then be a modification per se, because it would have been consistent with the variable, depending on where the kids were and the time the parents were spending. But how much of that, because we have so few findings on this issue, as we talked about already, to know that's how the district court looked at it?
Sure. So obviously the entire file came over and was registered, and the judge here had extensive knowledge of the file. It is hard to tell because of the lack of findings. But what I would like to note is that the district court acknowledged that there were some changes to the previous order. So that tells me that the district court was aware of what had been done previously. To Ms. Gallenberg's point, and I'll just address this, no one expressly motioned for a change of the extracurricular activity expenses. But when the court analyzed all this, and each litigant, each movant put in their motion for other and such further relief as the court may deem just and equitable. And that opens the door. That says, you know, judge, if there's something else that you think would make this in the best interest of the children, would potentially cut down on future litigation, would make things more clear moving forward. And I believe that's, she even goes so far in the order to say that that's why she was doing it, was to try to clarify the prior order, because of course in Minnesota, we don't have a term variable expenses. And given that we had one emancipated child and one child with a different custodial situation than we initially came into Minnesota, I think she was looking forward. We're talking about child support. We're talking about support for the children. Extracurriculars oftentimes goes hand in hand with that. And so she's saying, I'm going to clarify what this means. As your honors are likely aware too, the PICS percentages are their parental, like the pro rata percentages of income for each parent. So it also took into consideration each parent's financial ability to provide for those extracurricular activities. There's no requirement that the order say how much the monthly activities are or the yearly activities. There's no requirement that the court makes findings or limits on saying there needs to be a cap on this. I believe.
Is it clear what the term extracurricular activities includes?
It's not defined in the order, Your Honor.
Phrase, I should say.
Yep, no, it's not defined in the order. I have seen orders that have provided more context around what extracurricular activities are. I think for practitioners that work in this area, we define it as, you know, sports, camps, sometimes things like riding lessons, and the materials that accompany doing all of those things, but it's not defined in the order. There isn't a definition in the statute or in the order.
What is your thought, counsel? You heard our discussion with the appellant's counsel that a possible remedy different perhaps than what appellant's requesting is a remand simply because of the lack of findings on these two issues, and you're both kind of commenting on things you think that the district court was thinking,
yeah,
but we don't have it in front of us to be able to meaningfully review as we our case law would suggest in order to determine whether it was an abuse of discretion error at all.
I think candidly, as it relates to the extracurricular issue, there's no need for any more explicit findings. There's nothing in case law or statute that requires that. Your Honor asked about the McNulty case, and obviously that was a continuation on of a standard of living that a child had. I totally agree that that doesn't create any type of law that requires that there be, and first of all, I don't think it was an upward deviation here anyway, but even if it was, the court went through and made the requisite findings about the party's financial situation, but it was a continuation and clarification of something that had been ordered. So I don't think for extracurriculars that there'd be any point or any necessary remand language that would be needed. The tax dependency exemption, I will, you know, acknowledge is a little bit stickier because all the findings are woven throughout the order. They're not like kind of tied up in this nice little bow in the tax dependency exemption paragraph. But I go back to the extensive analysis that the court did and had to do as it related to spousal maintenance and as it related to child support and as it related to my client's argument that the appellant was underemployed. And so when I take a look at this, I think all of the information is there in the statute, but it's not in this sort of like bullet pointed, like here's the court's analysis on this particular paragraph.
Or in the section covering the tax credit.
Correct, yes. But I think it's definitely woven throughout the order. And when I take that coupled with, there's long lines of cases that the district court has broad discretion to provide for the support of children, to provide for these types of issues. And the court goes on to acknowledge, yes, I know I'm making this change to the dependency exemption and also a clarification of the dependency exemption, but a change to the tax dependency allocation, but they say this is in the best interest of the children, and this is because of the current custodial arrangement. So it's not as clean as perhaps it could be. Does it rise to the level of abuse of discretion? I submit that it does not, because the court did a lot of analysis here.
Where in the court's order do you think it covered the factors, the statutory factors?
Certainly, Your Honor. So when I turn into the, it's generally speaking held, first of all, the best interests of the children in the guardian ad litem, paragraph 17, somewhat in paragraph 19 in the COLA. And again, I agree. It doesn't go through and say, here I'm analyzing 518.38 subdivision B in this particular section. It talks about it quite a lot in paragraph 20, the modification of spousal maintenance. Generally speaking, the party's financial circumstances. It does not talk specifically about what would happen if a parent was not able to claim the tax, but dependency exemption, but the court did have the tax records and was able to review each party's tax returns. And then paragraph 21, where it talks about modification of support. So again, Your Honor, it doesn't go through and say, here's this line by line, but a totality of the reading of this order does have extensive analysis of the party's financial situation. So again, I just turn to the broad discretion of the district court. They have discretion to make the findings. They have discretion to make decisions on both of these topics. And the court exercised its discretion. And I think it's a challenge here to find that a discretion was abused. I'll touch, unless you have any other questions on those two issues or my points, I think I'll just touch briefly on the clerical error issue. I'm not trying to be difficult or challenging around that. I just think when there's procedures in place that should happen at the district court level, that's where that should occur. Appellant cites to Rule 6002 in their brief. And I think in order to know exactly what the appellate or the district court meant by that, that's the procedure that it should go through. I also think it's probably harmless error because the order also lays out, you know, what the parenting time schedule is.
I was going to ask that. So, I'm assuming, number one, there hasn't been no one's approached the district court regarding it, but it looks right. Like the court indeed adopted the guardian ad litem. So it was just an errant not.
Yes. I mean, I don't, yes, I think it was an errant not. I think it's harmless error. The order lays out, you know, what the schedule
and
is.
And that's how the parties have been operating consistent with that order.
Correct. Okay. So Your Honors, I would cede the rest of my time on this. There's any other questions I can answer for the court.
I don't see any further questions, so thank you. Any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have a few points on rebuttal. I just wanted to note that at the time we had the hearing, we agreed to make proposed orders, which were submitted to the court in MCRO as documents 85 to 87. Each party submitted a proposed order. In Mr. Colburn's proposed order, that was the first time there had been a provision included regarding sharing extracurricular activities. In Mr. Colburn's proposed order, he actually agreed that he owed Ms. Colburn the $2,500 as the cost or the lost benefit to her of the 2023 tax exemption. And in his proposed order, he actually said that moving forward, the parties would alter, or he would be awarded the tax credits for the children and that Ms. Colburn would not be awarded them anymore. And so I think what happened, rather than, you know, I disagree with counsel that the court had done this thorough analysis and really thought about this. I think what happened is the court was in a hurry to get the order out. The court acknowledged at the hearing that she was getting ready to retire. Our orders were due July 2nd, and the court issued the order July 11th. I think what happened was, and my guess is, the court just put in what Mr. Colburn had in part of his order and changed it to allocate the tax credits.
Did your client, was there time, or did your client bring that to the court's attention once you saw the proposed order? In other words, mainly the point that it's something that had not been argued and you would like an opportunity to respond to it, something along those lines?
Given kind of the time frame and the July 4th holiday, the order issued so quickly, and then by the time we got the order, I was in a position to say, like, where did this come from? Because there was no motion pending. So at that point, I went back and read the order, and I'm like, well, he's put this other stuff in his order. I just wanted to clarify that in response to counsel's comment that the district court in Wisconsin paused the payment of variable expenses. And I note that the variable expenses are very clearly defined under Minnesota law or under Wisconsin law. If you look at the original judgment and decree that issued in 2019, there's actually, it's kind of like our Appendix A where they attach what and define what variable expenses are. So in March of 2023, it's the March 10th of 2023 order, the court clearly said that variable expenses are not an issue since January 7th of 2022 because Mr. Colburn had sole, they call it placement in Wisconsin. So the court terminated any obligation that Ms. Colburn would have had to contribute to those variable expenses. So when counsel is talking about the court clarifying or modifying the prior order, the most recent order is the March 10th of 2023 order. And this order also contemplated, because the case was coming to Minnesota, that Minnesota would apply Minnesota law to the case. So we're not applying Wisconsin law here. And under Wisconsin law, according to this order anyway, I don't practice in Wisconsin, but under Wisconsin law, there were no variable expenses being shared between the parties. In response to counsel's comment that the entire file came over, all the documents that came over are in MCRO. And it actually was just the most recent certified copies of orders that came over. The documents in Wisconsin were very lengthy and did not all come over. And I just wanted to end by saying this extracurricular expense is of concern to me. There's no cap on it. There's no ceiling. If there had been a deviation of child support ordered, at least it would have an amount that Ms. Colburn could expect to be paid. We don't know what constitutes an extracurricular expense, and it kind of puts the parties in a position of needing to figure that out. I would also note that Mr. Colburn now has sole physical, well, technically legal custody, and then the physical custody label is actually called placement in Wisconsin. And so he's kind of in the position of scheduling more of the activities and things that cost money. And there's no upper ceiling on what Ms. Colburn would even be paying for these extracurricular activities. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your arguments here today and your helpful briefing. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.